is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The Alaska Range is the most dramatic topographic feature in Alaska and among the greatest in the world, with North America's tallest peak. We all know that, but you really don't know it until you see it. On today's show, we'll be talking about the Alaska Range and the effort to capture it in a new book. Photographer Carl Batriel spent years photographing these immense mountains and the extraordinary weather and light, and put those pictures in his new volume called The Alaska Range. And the book also includes essays by some of Alaska's most noted writers and adventurers. And in the second half of today's show, we'll have the treat of hearing from one of them, Art Davidson, who is a member of the first climb ever to summit Denali in the winter. But right now I have Carl with me, who has been on the show a couple of times before, talking about photography. He is a mountaineer and a photographer, and spent, more than 10 years getting these pictures, right?
Correct.
So how did you originally decide to do a book on the Alaska Range?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. It actually happened, the idea came on my wedding. My wife and I and two friends flew to the Ruth Gorge in early March and got married. And then we spent 10 days exploring. And it was a really cold trip. So there was a lot of tent time and map looking at time. So I started poring over maps, and I realized, wow, there was a lot of blank spaces in the Alaska Range that I had never even seen photographs of, places I'd never even heard of. And from then on, that kind of sparked the idea of about doing a photo book of the Alaska Range. And in 2005 is when I really started to photograph it. So,
what was your overall goal? Were you trying to sort of cover the whole thing? I mean, we're trying to sort of tell people what the whole thing looks like?
Exactly. I wanted to go from essentially the eastern border, which is about where it collides with the Wrangell Mountains on the Canadian border there. So the Nuzotin Mountains are the farthest of the Alaska Range in Alaska. Some even claim it goes into Canada, but I didn't go that far. I just stayed on the border. And then it goes all the way around in a big arc over to where it kind of collides into the Aleutian Range. And there's some discrepancies at the end there about what's the Alaska Range and what's this, what's that. But I went all the way into the Neocolas as my final end on the other side. And everything in between.
Wow. How many trips did it take you to cover all that ground?
I did 30 expeditions.
Wow, that's incredible. So, over 11 years?
Over 11 years, yeah. In 2013, the end of 2012, I decided that I would not do any other projects, not do anything but focus on finishing the Alaska Range. So 13, 14, and 15, I did nothing but go on trips to the Alaska Range. So it's been kind of go for it for the past 3 years. And then this last year has just all been about working on the book and layouts and writing and all that stuff that goes involved.
Gets involved with that. Tell me about one of these trips and what you've got all the complications and challenges of a mountaineering trip to a remote place where very few people go, which is okay, that's pretty hard. And then on top of it, you're really hoping for the right weather and the right light and the right, and you don't really know what you're going to take a picture of because nobody's been there to look at it before.
Right. And I used to kind of plan my trips using Google Earth and maps and things of sort like that. But once I get there, I am really, I just have to see what the weather's going to do because as we all know, anybody that's gone in the backcountry in Alaska, it could rain the whole time. And it has. I've had trips completely killed by pouring rain for a week and not taking a single photograph. So it can be frustrating at times, and it can be expensive. As we know also, that bush flights have gotten really, really expensive.
Yeah.
So I have to put in, I have to at some point make a commitment. I have canceled a few trips based on what the weather forecast was going to be.
Painful.
But
Which I would just say is not the Alaskan way, right?
It's not the Alaska way. The Alaska way is just to go, and that's how it has always been. But what usually happens is I have about three or four places that I really want to get to, and we have one, and if that's not going to go, because Alaska Range is 650 miles long, we can go to a different spot.
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of how we've done it, where we have a backup plan, and the backup plan is to ski in or to hike in this different area and avoid the fly-in. avoid the cost and the potential for being stuck, because that has happened too. I've been overdue 5 days, as much as 5 days at a time from when our pickup was, you know, rationing food and all that. It's just not a lot of fun.
No. So did you, in going to these obscure locations, did you discover some mountains and some vistas that, like, nobody knew about and that were just spectacular? I mean, were there some examples where you just went, wow, I just discovered Yosemite or whatever?
Well, there are a pocket of those places. There are also a handful of adventurers out there that know these places. A few of them, especially some of the Fairbanks crew, don't even like to talk
about
them.
They keep it to themselves, yeah. Right?
They like to keep them secret. But I found a lot of peaks. I've photographed a lot of impressive mountains that didn't have names. And when they get seen by a lot of the people, there's just this huge rush. When I show one online or something, I get a huge rush of emails saying, where is that? How do I get there? You know, give me as much beta as possible. And I find that pretty inspiring. But there's also just
So in some of the pictures you've taken, people have said, I want to be the first one to climb that, yep. And the race is on.
And the race is on, and it happens a lot.
That's cool.
Rehad One and the Neocola is the Citadel. And there was a photo published in a magazine, Alpinist, and online. And I got an email from a climber, Matt Heliker, in England. And he saw that photo, and he says, we have to come climb that. So they flew down here right in the spring and bought a camera crew and made a movie about the ascent.
Oh, wow.
And everything. So it was pretty cool. So, and then I've had other climbers use the photographs as inspiration to make new ascents, climb new routes. I like that aspect. It's kind of that's an Alaska tradition too, set by Bradford, you know.
Yeah, that's you're like,
inspire climbers to go out.
Brad Washburn.
Yeah, exactly. Tease them a little and say, hey, there's lots out there, but there are some pretty hardcore young guys out there right now, and you know Clint Helander, who's in the book, he's one of them that are out there, getting away from the standard stuff and finding unclimbed peaks and new areas to explore.
Yeah, so tell me about your own mountain interest. I mean, did you start in this as a climber and alpinist, and does the photography part sort of feed that, or is it? Because you actually don't want to take all your pictures from the top of the mountain, right?
Not at all. Yeah. I rarely climb. I rarely climb mountains when I'm out photographing. I go through them. I'm a point A to point B kind of guy, and so climbing, making ascents, is the last priority. And so I've had to pick my companions. I'm very selective about my companions, and it's really a core of five guys and girls, because they have to be willing to sacrifice their own goals for the sake of photography. With that said, we did one time, my climbing partner or adventure partner, you might say, of 12 years, I finally said, you know, he deserves to climb a peak. So we went out to the New Zotans out in the far end of the Alaska Range, where there's just a stack of unclimbed, unnamed mountains. And we put up a first ascent. I said, you know what? This will be the priority first. So we went and we climbed this peak and we had a good time. And then we explored and photographed for another week. But I fell in love with the mountains. I was a photographer right out of high school, and I didn't really fall in love with the big mountains until I made my first ascent of California's Mount Shasta. Uh-huh. And it was the glaciers that actually attracted me. And so I started following the glaciers, the Cascades, the Himalaya, and then moved to Alaska. And so it was really the glaciers, which I think we've talked about before, mm-hmm. that really inspired me. And then, you know, then the mountains, of course, and the glaciers are together. They're one thing to me. So that alpine, it's really the alpine country that I'm in love with.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know another book where somebody has set out to sort of document a mountain range from one end to the other. I mean, typically, I think a photographer will go out and have a topic and they'll just get the best pictures they can generally get and put them in a book on just purely an aesthetic basis. And you've sort of tried to do something that adds another dimension of difficulty to that in a way, by saying you actually want to represent this range.
Right. I wanted to give, you know, it's initially you know, maybe the vision was just a book of big, bold mountain photographs, just mm-hmm. in your face, like epic. But then when I started talking to the Mountaineers, the publisher, you know, we kind of said, you know, that's limiting. That's not telling the whole story. Mm-hmm. And they were thinking, well, it needs to be more than just the mountains. It needs to be the whole story. And I realized they were correct. You know, we needed to show what grows in the Alaskan Range, what lives in the Alaska Range, who explores in the Alaska Range, and the different environments from the, you know, the forest all the way up to the high alpine. And I think so that, and then I think it's a better book in general. As much as I dreamt about the huge big mountain book, only mountains and nothing but mountains, I think in the end this is a better representation of the entire Alaska Range, and it does it. I mean, this is something that I think is overdue. I mean, there's been books of so many other mountain ranges, and I couldn't believe when I researched this. I said, well, I better research, and there had never been a photo book of the entire Alaska Range, and it just blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, you think about how many pictures have you seen of Denali? I mean, it's like almost to the point of yes. cliche.
Well, and that was a hard thing because, and I talk about that
just
a little.
Just finding a new way to.
Photograph Denali, yeah. New way to photograph all the big mountains, that whole Denali National Park area. I mean, there's pockets of Denali National Park that no one ever goes to. Majority of it no one ever goes to. But there are those classic peaks that I was like, how do I get a different view of that? How do I do something unique? We joke that there's not a photo of Denali from Wonder Lake in this book. Yeah. Now, there are photos near that area, but I was like, I can't do it. It's just, that's out there.
That's been done.
Yeah, that's done. Everybody's seen that. So that's not necessarily representative of the whole of Denali itself. There's other views. So I was out to definitely try and get a different view.
Cool.
Was hard.
And it's a great book. I'm talking to Carl Batrial, who's just published the book, The Alaska Range, Exploring the Last Great Wild. And Carl is going to be presenting his slides at the Beartooth Theater on November 28th at 5:30 p.m. There's a $4 cover fee that goes to benefit Alaska Mountain Rescue, and that'll be a great opportunity to get a copy of the book and get a signature from Carl. And are any of your co-authors going to be there?
Well, Roman Dial and Clint Helander are giving talks that night too.
Perfect.
So there's three of us. And
for mountain lovers, that'll be the place to be on November 28th.
Yep. And so Roman and Clint, you could probably harass them to give you a signature too.
Cool. So let's talk about the range itself. What makes, I mean, you've climbed a lot of other mountains, it sounds like. What is the unique characteristic of the Alaska Range?
Well, it's kind of a combination of the coastal stuff that you get in the Chugach, big glaciers and all that, and then the Brooks Range, which is a little much drier and steeper and rockier. So the Alaska Range is a beautiful combination of both. It's got beautiful sections of granite, which, you know, obviously the Ruth Gorge is legendary, but there's also the Kitchatna Spires and the Revelations and a lot of other areas that are like world-class rock, you know, and
this huge verticality.
We all know the Ruth Gorge, which mm-hmm. is, you know,
twice the depth of the Grand Canyon.
And it's like Yosemite times 10, you know, like an El Capitan, like 10 El Capitan. Well, the Kitchatnas are even more inspiring. I mean, the Kitchatnas just blow your mind when you're in there. And then you got other areas like the Revelations, and which also, and even the Neocolas down there at in Lake Clark National Park, just gorgeous rock. So you got this rock coming out of the ice, and it's you know, growing up in California, I've seen that rock, that vertical gain, but it's missing the glaciers. It's those were long gone. So this is kind of like seeing, going in the past and seeing what a Yosemite and the High Sierras was like. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty spectacular like that. Some parts of the Alaska Range, like the eastern, what they call the Eastern Alaska Range, where Mount Deborah and Mount Hayes and all those peaks are, one side, the tundra literally almost just goes right to the base of this vertical wall, so you can almost walk the tundra right to the vertical mountain and go straight up. So it's amazing. Pretty impressive. Yeah, that's a really spectacular area to explore too.
It must have been just a huge pleasure to be out there, kind of as an explorer, finding places that, you know, hardly anybody's ever gone to before, and just saying like, wow, that's amazing, right?
Yeah, and every trip is a wow, look at that, wow, uh-huh. You know, and so the Alaska Range supplies so much of that wow, look at that, and a lot of it is accessible by the road. I mean, believe it or not, we've done a lot of especially ski trips where we just accessed from the road. From the Denali Highway, or even the Richardson Highway, mm-hmm. The Delta Mountains and the Deborah Hayes Range, they're both accessible by skis in the winter really easily. And within a day, you could be surrounded by epic scenery. I mean, epic scenery.
Wow.
So I think people are intimidated by the Alaska Range in some ways. But also they think it's all flying, it's all expensive. But one of my favorite areas is the Delta Mountains, and it's right off the Richardson Highway. And you can get to some great country summer or winter really quickly.
Cool. What was the toughest spot to reach?
Oh, boy.
You have a long list, huh?
Yeah. You know, the roughest area, the hardest to get to because it's so remote, is the Revelation Mountains and the area in between the Torjrio Mountains, which is Mount Spur, which we see across there. In between the Revelations and the Torjrios is a section of mountains that they are locally mountains. It is just a sea of nameless question marks. Few pilots even know where that you can land. It's insanely expensive because most of the landings are experimental. It's like, we could try to land in that lake. We can try to land on that gravel bar. No, we don't know if we can do it. And there's a lot of that. And that's really exciting.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's heartbreaking when you go by and the pilot says, we're not landing there.
And you've already spent your $2,000.
And you're like, we got to land somewhere else. And maybe it's 20 miles from where we had hoped to land. The next, you know. One year we went out to the Revelations and the lake was frozen that we were going to land on. We had to land 10 miles down lower elevation to a lake that wasn't frozen.
And what do you do when that happens? You just like say, well, we got to hike up there.
In the next spot and we hike up, right, and we do a little change. I make sure that I have enough maps to cover a pretty broad range of area that we could travel in. I don't cover a lot of ground on my trips.
Because you're taking pictures.
Because I'm taking pictures. And one of the funny stories I have is one time I went on a trip where a friend of mine, Chris, who is a racer, you know, a wilderness classic racer, you know, and he had never gone on a real trip like this with me. And so my buddy Cy, who goes on all the trips with me, we go where we stay when the weather's nice. We dig in and we photograph,
right.
And we move when the weather's lousy and stuff. Well, he's the opposite. He's right. Like, so he's like, it's nice out, let's get going. We're like, no, now we set camp and we go photograph and we explore when the weather's nice. And so it's definitely a different mentality than the people that are climbers or you know, racers, because they want to go when the weather's good.
Yeah.
And we want to photograph when the weather's good.
It's goal-oriented, a totally different kind of goal.
So, yeah. Like I said earlier, that you definitely kind of, I have to pick my, because I've had lots of people say, can I come on your trips? And I've been invited on a lot of expeditions, and I usually have to say no on both, and simply because we just don't match up. I'm like, I don't have the skill level to climb really hard routes, and nor would I photography would simply be sacrificed.
Right.
And then the other way around is I got a lot of friends that are just tough and strong in the mountains, and they just bored out of their mind on a trip like mine. Usually they have to just go. I have flown in with guys where we land at base camp and we say, see you in a week. I go one way. We share the flight costs.
Right.
But I go one way and they go their way and we meet back for pickup.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes that works too.
And I would imagine you're hauling a lot of heavy camera gear around.
Right, yep. I'm a minimalist when it comes to most camera gear and outdoor gear. So I do, the funny thing is I treat even these pretty gentle, in the Alaska scheme of things, expeditions, like I'm on a burly mountain climb. So minimal amount of stuff, minimal amount of food, minimal amount of camera gear. I usually take a camera and one lens, And at the most, I'll take two lenses. I never take more than two lenses. So I usually just have one camera body, a lens, and one other lens. And that's it. So a tripod, because I'm still old school, and I'm still a landscape photographer, and maximum quality is still what I'm after. So I still use DSLRs with high resolution and all that, and tripods. So I'm kind of old school in that respect. Mm-hmm. But
is there any wildlife or in vegetation and sort of not mountain stuff in
there? 100%. There's a lot of close-up macro stuff of plants and flowers. There's a lot of wildlife. In fact, a lot more wildlife than most people would expect. And I had to go out of my way and do, because wildlife photography has become a different beast.
It takes a lot of patience.
And equipment.
Well, they both do, I guess.
Right. So it's a different, it wasn't a struggle for me, but I had to actually go on wildlife trips, mm-hmm. where the goal was wildlife. Now, there are a handful of photographs in here where, especially wildlife in the landscape photos, where I took them on one of my standard expeditions. But there's a handful of photographs, especially bears, where I had to go out to photograph bears because you need special equipment to keep your distance and to do it safely.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the bear photographs, people are like, how did you get that shot? Well, I actually had to specifically go out to photograph bears and carry a big telephoto and like just for the project. So.
Wow. Hey, we're talking to Carl Battrell, who's just completed this book, Alaska Range, Exploring the Last Great Wild. And you can see his slides and meet him and get a signed book, The Beartooth, on the 28th of November, 5:30. There's a $4 fee, and some of the authors will also be speaking there. I'm thinking, Carl, that a lot of our listeners are just like dying of envy as they think, wow, this guy's job is just to climb around the mountains and take pictures. But they may not know just how hard it is to do a book and get it published, and that this is like the worst way to make money in the world, right? You know, pennies the hour.
Oh, less than pennies. People ask this a lot, and whether or not, you know, that I have the greatest job on earth, and I do have a great job, but it's not a money making adventure. You do it because you love it, and you do it because you love the mountains.
Well, how did you get this one started? Because the finances of it, I mean, it's obviously these trips are expensive. The printing of a book like this is really expensive. Other people involved, the writers who you've recruited.
Right. So it's an expensive ordeal. Almost the entire, all the expeditions were funded by me. And usually what I do is I go on a trip and then I try and sell that story. I sell the photographs to magazines to show. The goal for me really was, when it comes to the trips, is just to break even. You pay for the flights, pay for the food, the equipment. And I usually can do that through the sale of photographs. And then when it came to the book, and we approached the publisher, the Mountaineers out of Seattle, who really wanted to do the book, but they're like, photo books are so, so expensive to produce. And they frequently they usually lose money. Plain and simple. I mean, you go to Barnes & Noble and you look at those discount racks, and it's always photo books. The photo books, they're just ditching them because they're expensive. And people are so used to looking at photography online that they don't necessarily have the patience to sit down and look at a photo book, as sad as that is. So the publishers are weary of it. So we had to do a Kickstarter campaign in order to help raise the funds to print the book and to offset loss that could happen. Now, I think it's been an extremely popular Kickstarter event, was very successful. And so I think that the publisher has a lot more confidence in it, and I do too, that the people want this, the climbing community, the outdoor community, the Alaskans, everybody wants it, and they wanted this book. And so I think it's going to do great. And it's a huge risk for everybody. And it's difficult.
But it's something amazing to have. I mean, it must have been a great feeling to finally get it in your hands and see it all there collected.
100%. It's always a surprise to see it, you know, that it's finished. So here it is, mm-hmm. this concept that I had 11, 12 years ago. It's exciting. It's a little overwhelming.
It's a decade of your life.
Yeah, and I'm in fact, my wife's thinks that I'm just wandering around aimlessly these days, like, what am I going to do next? Because there is that big release of, like, and then there's, like, what am I going to do
What's
next?
Your purpose in life, right? But and you've got these pretty impressive writers. I mean, a really great collection of writers to work on this, and not just people who are, like, freelancer who happens to write about anything, but people like Roman Dial, who it's actually traversed the entire range, and Art Davidson, who we're going to hear from in the second half, who was the first winner ascent of the range. What was that like, recruiting those guys?
You know, I had a good list, and I ended up narrowing it down to A, they had to have spent a significant amount of their time in the Alaska Range. That was number one. Number two is I really wanted them to be Alaskans. Not necessarily born and raised in Alaska, but lived a good portion of their life in Alaska. And every one of them, except for Art, who lives in Alaska and Colorado, still lives in Alaska. So it was important that it be an all Alaskan book, that they spent a lot of time in the Alaska Range, and that they were excited about the project. Because I had a few people that are on my list, and I contacted them, and they didn't really show that excitement towards it. And that was, I'm like, okay.
But then I think that was a really good idea, because a lot of times when writers take on something like massive scenery, they immediately get carried away and write sort of a very BS-y kind of travelogue thing. And you've got some real guys who spent a lot of time out there, and so they're writing about it the way somebody who really has spent time and internalized it will write.
Right, and they all have a very personal connection to the mountains. Mm-hmm. Most of them aren't professional writers at all. So the editors had a little more of a struggle with that, but to me, it made it more personal book for everybody. And I think that they all, like I said, they all wanted to contribute. You know, sight unseen, yes, that was the answer.
That's
right.
Cool.
Away. And so that was my check mark. Okay, you're in because you want to do this. You love the Alaska Range like I love the Alaska Range, and you want to just be part of it.
Well, are you bummed that you're not going to have this reason to go out anymore?
Well, I need a new project to go out.
Yeah.
The thing is with the Alaska Range is it's still...
There's always more. Yeah.
And it's right there, and we keep, you know, every day it's a clear out. I see Denali, and I see the Alaska Range, and I see the Tordrillos and the Neocolas and all the Kachatnas out there, and I just, it still brings up this, like, I want to get out. I want to get out.
So, yeah. So,
but there's other mountains to go explore, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems like you would need to keep hitting new terrain in order to kind of do what you're doing, which is selling pictures for people who want to see what's to climb next, right?
Right, right. Well, and that's been it's an odd niche, but my niche has been for the past 15, 20 years has been the photographer who photographs things that no one else photographs.
Right.
I don't do well in stock sales and stuff because that's not what they're looking
for.
Too obscure, but I do well with those who are interested in those things, and I think there's more interest in those as the population gets bigger, and you know, more interest, that there is growing interest in these remote pockets of the world, and Alaska has stacks of these places.
Finding the last corners. Yeah. Well, great. It's I recommend the book to everyone, Carl Batrail's book, The Alaska Range. As I said, he'll be presenting on November 28th at the Beartooth. Thanks for being with me, Carl.
All right, thank you.
All right, stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about the Alaska Range, inspired by this great new book which has come out. And we heard in the first half from the photographer who is kind of behind the book, Carl Batrail. And the text of the book comes in a series of essays from a lot of really interesting Alaskans. And the foreword is by a writer who I've wanted to meet for many years. been aware of his work sort of since I was a kid. Art Davidson, who is a legendary climber, spent a life documenting Alaska and many years climbing in the Alaska Range, and was the first to climb Denali in the wintertime, which was the subject of his classic and very, very popular book, Minus 148. Thanks for being here, Art.
Charles, it's great to be here with you and to celebrate the coming out, the publication of this book, which is really a fabulous book. I really applaud the photographer, Carl, and I like the work of the other writers. It's a great, great book.
It's a beautiful book. And it seems like it's trying to capture something which must be very dear to your heart, which is this immense range, this massive, incredible thing that has been a big part of your existence, I guess, since you were a young man.
Yeah. And you know, it captures a lot of the essence of this range. And I see the book in a way as an invitation to people, all kinds of people, to come and enjoy the park. There's so many mm-hmm. different ways to enjoy it, different aspects to it. You know, when I first came to Alaska, I was just a kid and I was living in a tent, and every chance I got, I went out climbing with friends or by myself in the Chugach. And Denali, or McKinley, as we called it in those days, I'm very happy we're calling it Denali, but it always loomed there in the north.
Yeah.
And I just had so little money, I couldn't think of putting together an expedition to go there. But the second summer, I met a friend, a Japanese climber who was here, and he stayed and studied here. And so the second summer I was here, he invited me to climb Denali with the Japanese.
So what year would we be talking
about? We'd be talking about 1965.
Wow. Yeah.
So I went on the mountain with this the Osaka Alpine Club. Uh-huh. And it was really touching because here, just at that time, it was only 20 years earlier that my father had been fighting their fathers.
Yeah.
And the leader, the elder leader, I mean, he was in World War II. And to be there on the mountain in that peaceful situation, it was just incredible.
Well, you weren't elbowing too many people out of the way in those
days.
No,
in those days, we were, for most of the time we were on Denali, we went up the south side to put a new route up the south side, the south face of the mountain. We were the only climbing party on the mountain, which seemed normal. It was normal. That's how it was in those days. I remember the first adventure of going with the Japanese was the food. First couple of days, I saw a lot of rice. I saw quite a bit of seaweed, more rice, some dried plums, but I'd seen on the sheet of all the equipment and food some very good items. It was like meat. It was chops and steaks. So after 3 or 4 days, I asked my friend Shiro, "What are you guys going to get out the chops and the steaks?" He said, "Chops, steaks." I said, "Yeah," and I pulled out my list of all the food. No, chopsticks. It was misspelled. But I had a great time. And it was on that climb in the summertime when we had a terrific time. And, you know, it sometimes is warm on the lower glaciers in the summer, all the sun reflecting off the snow and the ice. We saw these incredible avalanches come down. And you look up and you see these massive cornices. You know, that's where the wind, as you know, blows the snow and it curls over the top of a ridge. And I got to thinking, what would it be like up here in the wintertime?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what kind of storms create those massive, massive cornices? And I talked to Shiro about it, and it was like, I mean, how would you survive up here? Could you climb in that darkness? How cold is it going to get? And how hard is the wind going to blow? What are the storms going to be like? What kind of equipment would you have to have? We'll have to have headlamps, I guess.
You'd really be pushing the absolute most extreme climbing situation on Earth because you're so close to the pole and it's so little light, it's so cold.
Yeah.
It's kind of equivalent to Antarctica.
Yeah. So my first big surprise was it was hard to find people to join us.
Yeah.
We asked some of the biggest names, some of the most experienced climbers in the country, And virtually all of them said, "Look, you guys are crazy. I mean, you're not going to make it. You're not going to be able to climb the mountain. And you were lucky to survive."
And it's not like you'd, I mean, you can tell me, but it's not like you'd already climbed all the tallest peaks in the world or anything like
that. No, that was not even an item that people did in those days.
You're kind of a young, energetic newcomer, essentially.
And so the guys that joined us, you know, Shiro and myself, Dave Johnston from Talkeetna, he was ready to do it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Blomberg was a friend of mine from Colorado who made equipment. He started out the same time Chouinard did. You know, Chouinard, of course, went on to found Patagonia. And we had a New Zealander, Dr. George Wickman from Anchorage, a powerful, strong, very experienced climber, Jacques Batkin, nicknamed Farine, who had from France, who had climbed Huntington with a really legendary climber, Lionel Touré, and Regenet. So actually, Regenet kind of talked his way onto our trip at the last moment, and we looked at him a little suspect. I mean, he was all this bundle of energy, but he really hadn't climbed that much. But his friend Farine really had, so we invited them to join us. But Charles, the thing is, you know, and there was no sense of that anybody would be talking about this the next year.
It's just something you're doing.
No sense that we would be writing a book or that you and I would be sitting here many years later and talking about that.
Yeah.
It was just, and it was the call of the unknown,
mm-hmm.
I think, more than anything, and a chance to try something that hadn't been done, and we didn't know if we could do it or if it could be done.
Yeah.
And so figuring out how to deal with those elements, the cold, and Denali is cold in the summertime. Its winds and storms can be very fierce, and people have lost their lives, as you know, in all seasons. So we were able to find eight of us, six others besides Shiro and myself, and you know, and we climbed the mountain, and as I say in the book, we'd set out to explore, in the foreword to the book, mm-hmm. I say we had set out to explore a world of ice, cold, and darkness. But it is what we learned about ourselves that has made enduring difference in our lives. And we came away with this deep joy of being alive, being with friends, and being able to stand and walk and feel the warmth of the sun on their face. As you know, and maybe some of your listeners know, we were caught by a tremendous storm, I mean, a week-long storm.
We're so lucky to have survived.
Very lucky, and you know, our companions, there were just three of us, Dave Johnston, Regenet, and myself, reached the summit. On the way down, we were trapped by this incredible storm at 18,000 feet, very near the summit.
And what month of the year is this?
This is the end of February, the 1st of March. And we were trapped, we dug under the ice in this tiny little ice cave, and the storm went 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. And our friends gave us up for dead. There was no way we could be alive. And they would stay there and try to help us, but they couldn't climb in that wind. They mm-hmm. couldn't reach us. They knew there was no way we could be alive.
And no, rescue, completely impossible. Not even really something to think about. Yeah.
But we were able to just hunker down and spend that week underneath the ice and barely were able to climb down. Our feet were half frozen. And you know, I saw a movie recently. It's called The Revenant. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know the meaning of that word before, but it means someone who comes back from the dead or somebody believed to be dead who comes back. And in that movie, he comes back and his heart is filled with revenge for somebody who injured his, killed his son.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I have found, and the three of us who were left for dead, and others like Joe Simpson, who wrote a wonderful book called Touching the Void, Nando Prado, one of those Uruguayan rugby players that was lost in the Andes.
Yep.
You know, you come back and you have this new, deep appreciation of being alive. And it's more like, as Nando Prado says, he says, the opposite of death, he says to me, after that experience, his experience on the other side, so to speak, is love.
Mm.
You just, your heart goes out. You feel a new connection to people and the earth. So anyway, that was...
Yeah.
That climb was an early experience in my life,
and it became you kicked off your career as a writer because the book that came out of it was a huge international bestseller.
Well, it did and it didn't. Yes, it was successful and it was printed in different languages, but you know, early on, I didn't want to be a writer.
Really,
I didn't want to go around writing other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting somebody and, oh, tell me about that. Oh, yes, what? And then what did you do? And making my little notes. -148 came from my heart and from our experience. And that if I was going to write, it was that type of thing that I would write about. So later I wrote, when I wrote with the Yupik Chiefs, a book about the subsistence way of life, I'd worked with them and lived out there a long time, and that was something very close to my heart. When the oil spill happened, the Exxon Valdez, I wrote a book about that in the wake of the Exxon Valdez. And that just cut to the core of many Alaskans and myself because, you know, we benefit from oil. I'm not anti-oil. Yeah. I drive a pickup truck, for heaven's sakes. But the carelessness of the industry and the state.
And you really connected with the Native people in writing about the spill, and particularly the chief in Port Graham.
Yes.
And his name is escaping me at the moment, whose essay that I think you assisted him with has become a sort of a symbol of the Native Person reaction to this.
Well, it was his words. Yeah. Sometimes people can speak very simply, but so directly into the heart of the matter. So it was just
season
really...
Season of Dead Water was, I think,
yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. But anyway, back to the Denali and the Alaska Range. You know, after those two early climbs of Denali, one with the Japanese and then with our friends in the wintertime, I have had the good fortune to go back to the range many times. We had a terrific expedition to sort of a range within the range, the Kachatna Spires, way to the west. And Carl's photographs, he has some beautiful photographs of this region and also to the Revelations, which we actually named as a range. Clint Helander, one of the essayists, has climbed and written about that out there. These are areas, the Revelations of the Kachatnas. Again,
what a great name you came up with, huh?
Yeah, it was like from the Book of Revelations. Yeah. And but you know, these are places like Yosemite, but 10,000 years ago, the glaciers are there. They're carving those immense walls. And so you have these sheer granite walls, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 feet high.
I know.
Ice cool wars that go to heaven, you know.
We're talking with Art Davidson today about the Alaska Range. He's written the foreword to this fabulous new book on the Alaska Range, The Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. You got to exactly what I wanted to talk about, which is the incredible topography of this place, which I haven't been everywhere in the world, but I've never seen it repeated. I mean, the sheer immensity of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about the Sierra or Yellowstone and the mountains that are, we preserve national parks. Yeah, they're puny compared to the Alaska Range. And I think that, you know, if you look at Denali from, say, Wonder Lake, you're only at like 3,000 or 4,000 feet.
Yes.
You're probably looking at the biggest object that you can see on Earth, you know, everywhere else.
Well, Charles, you're right. Yeah. As I think you know, Denali is the highest mountain from its base to its summit in the world. It doesn't have the elevation, the sheer elevation in the stratosphere that Everest, say, has, but from its base rising out of the tundra up to those icy, arid slopes, very cold slopes, It's the biggest mountain.
You're never going to stand and look at something bigger. I mean, that's the biggest there is. And
I think so.
And this aspect you mentioned of the sheer cliffs. I mean, flying around it gives you a little bit of that sense when you think, how can this be this huge?
And you know, it's you talk about the landscape and the topography. It's both very young and very ancient.
Mm.
You know, you have places where the glaciers are retreating. And you see the ice just as, you see the rock just as it has been ground smooth by the ice, where it's peeled away the layers of silt and left it just polished smooth. And you see places where it was the ice left a few years ago, and the first little grasses and the little sedges and the little bushes are beginning to grow. And you see glaciers where there's moraine. And for some of our listeners, if you haven't been on moraine is this the rocks that have fallen off cliffs. They fall on the glacier. The glacier carries it down. And there's places where there's moraine, rocks and rubble and sand and gravel on the glacier where trees are sprouting.
Right.
I mean, the landscape is moving.
Yeah.
But so you have very new, fresh, just born yesterday kind of landscape, and also some very ancient places. We've known for some years that there are some amazing tracks of dinosaurs preserved remarkably well. You see their pad of their feet of these big predators. And just this last week they found some bones.
Yeah.
So part of Denali and what
and
you
we're
can find
recording, so it would be a couple of weeks ago, but yeah.
Yeah, some weeks ago, very recently. Yeah. They were just finding, and they say every day they're finding new things up there. And
the mountain is still growing like a, you know, immeasurably. Yeah.
And in between those ages, you have so much history. Geological history, which you know, the Jeff Benowitz, a geologist, writes about in the book. I love his description of Denali. He says, caught a great tectonic wave and has been riding it for 6 million years. It's like riding a surf for 6 million years. But the thing is, between those early times when the mountain was forming, being thrust up out of these tectonic plates, you have so much history. You know, about there are places where you can find where people camped with their families, their children, just as the last ice age was retreating about 10,000 years ago by that river, catching the same kind of grayling and trout and salmon that we see up there today. And, you know, we look back. We can't look completely through that veil of time. Mm-hmm. But being in a place like the Alaska Range, like the Denali National Park, you can come close to those different eras of the mountain, geologic, at, you know, the time of the first people being there. You can see where the miners came in. And interestingly enough, the creation of the park came about because of building the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
There was, the railroad was being built between Anchorage and Fairbanks, and the railroad workers needed food. So there were professional hunters that went out and got caribou, and they got moose.
Everything,
Well, you know, it seemed to be unlimited number of animals, and you could never make a dent in it.
Same as the buffalo.
Same as the buffalo, and same as the Stellar Sea Cow out of the Aleutians. It was hunted to extinction by the first Russian visitors. But anyway, there was this young guy from the East Coast, Charles Sheldon, and he came north in 1906. And he was just blown away as a young man with the beauty, the massive magnificence of the range. And at one point he said, the great mountain rose above me, you know, desolate, magnificent, overpowering. But he became concerned that too many animals were being killed and that, you know, he was a hunter himself. Mm-hmm. He was not anti-hunting. He hunted himself. But he said, This place is very special for all these animals and the interactions between the grizzlies, the wolves, the
which you can go up and see today.
And thanks in large part to Charles Sheldon and people who've come after him. He worked very hard convincing Congress early on to create a park, a preserve. And others have followed in his footsteps to help preserve our chance to see these wonderful animals interacting in the wild as they always have.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a zoo, not in a game park, not in a little patch where they are sort of wild. Those animals up there are wild. Yeah. They are wild.
Very much so. So I want to talk a little bit about photography because this is a photography book. And we talked to Carl, but you've worked with more than one photographer. Tom Walker, who did this amazing photography, you worked with him. And it's always seemed to me that there's this incredible challenge of capturing a place like this that is so enormous, so amazing, so grand, that it just pointing a camera, it diminishes it. I mean, if I do it, I look at what comes out on the other end and it's so much smaller. It's not there, you know. And so there's an amazing talent to doing that. And different photographers had different approaches or different ways of doing it.
You know, I think we take pictures of places or things or people and even use names to sort of say, well, that's what it is.
Right.
You know, grizzly bear. And, oh, I saw a grizzly bear. Check. I saw a moose. Mm-hmm. Check. And or you see a picture of a grizzly bear or a moose. So it's just one instant in time. It's a representation of that place, that creature. And it's not the real animal. It's not the real experience of being out there and living with them or being on those high ridges with the wind. But I think that there's a real value in artists painting different things and using their senses and their impressions of a place. And photographers like Carl and like Art Wolf, who I've worked with a lot.
I'm sorry, I said Art Wolf.
No, it's okay. No. And for photographers like Carl, they have this love mm-hmm. of the place and what's going on there. Mm-hmm. And they're out there. Carl has dedicated so many years. This book represents a life work of a really terrific photographer.
Yeah.
And I think he shows a great range of what, not just the Alaska Range, but a great range of what is within the range. From the tiny mosses and lichens, the snow, the animals, the birds, the ridges, the great massive walls of the mountains,
there's
the rivers.
There's a huge dedication to what he's created.
Incredible dedication. I mean, year after year, I mean, sometimes he'd go out with his knapsack and his camera and in the cold, the wind, the rain, the snow, and days, and go back again for days and not have a single image that mm-hmm. that has finally come to this book. So what we have in this book is a distillation, if you will, mm-hmm. of the images that he and the editors at Mountaineers Books felt really, I hate to say the word capture the range.
Capture one man's range, right?
Well, it's one man's visions, but I think of this book and these images and these essays, wonderful essays, as an invitation. You know, here's what we love. This is out mm-hmm. there. This is mm-hmm. a world treasure. It's right here in Alaska. It's on our doorstep, and we can go out there. And you know, the essays as well. When I started reading them by various people,
right, and Roman Dial's talking about his amazing journey across
Roman
the whole,
Dial, a crazy yeah. adventure. You know, he's yeah. up there with mountain bikes and yeah. fording rivers and little you know, his little pack rafts uh-huh. and things like that, and Jeff, the geologist, Verna Pratt, who mm-hmm. writes about the plant life, Bill Shawanet, you know, mm-hmm. is a good writer and knows animals, his times out there. And then people like Brian and Diane Auchinleck writing about the historic ascents and expeditions.
Legendary pilot, yeah.
And then Clint Helander, a wonderful young guy, wonderful mm-hmm. writer, and he writes about his experiences out there climbing some extreme things. Well, as I started to read their essays, I felt like this book is like coming around a campfire and being able mm-hmm. to sit down with these guys and with Verna, who really know the range and love it, certain aspects of it, mm-hmm. and know it really very well. And you get to hear their stories. You get to hear them talking about it.
Right.
So I think of this book as a really warm-hearted, dedicated invitation for people of all sorts to go out and enjoy the range. Mm-hmm. You know, I climbed mountains and climbed high and steep mountains when I was younger, but I've returned to the park many times. And sometimes I bring friends and family up in the summertime, and I take the bus through Denali Park, out to mm-hmm. Eielson, out to Wonder Lake. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
In the park and those animals and that wildness and that true heart, that old, ancient, vibrant, new heart of Alaska, is right there. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways to experience the range.
Yeah.
And I think that comes through in this book beautifully.
Yeah. Well, the Rashomon, the different perspectives of the different writers bringing yeah. it to us, and, yeah. and we see yeah. the many different angles. And the other thing is that the immensity of the range is something that's easily forgotten because we think of it as being just Denali National Park. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's one section, right?
Yes,
then you
that's
go
right.
east down the
that's
Denali right. Highway and to Richardson right. Highway, and
right.
you know, and it's really an extension of this Cordillera that runs all the way through North America.
So
you know, of course, it'll never be captured, which I guess is part of the romance of it.
Yes, yeah. Well, yes, and I think one thing I want to touch on is that you know, just what you said, part of the range is in the park, mm-hmm. and just part of that is classified as wilderness.
Right.
Well, wilderness is both a word we use for the wild, untrammeled, mm-hmm. You know, untracked backcountry that's more or less untouched by man. But wilderness is also a classification of land use management that tries to preserve those places in their natural state. A sanctuary for the animals and kind of a sanctuary for us to go and visit and find right. that solitude and that peace and that beauty.
And you mentioned your foreword going and looking for wolves and not finding any.
Well, yeah. yes. I mean, as a young guy, I like to film and make documentary movies. And I got a wonderful job one summer to go film The Wolves of Denali with Gordon Haber, a wonderful naturalist now departed.
Yeah, sadly.
And we had great weather, and we had a lot of time, and a very supportive producer. We had no wolves. That we saw one from the distance. Somebody had come in over the winter and landed in the park and shot up the packs, and they'd scattered. They'd been killed. Now, within the park itself and within the park, the boundaries of protection, I don't believe that happens very much anymore. But what does happen is just outside the boundaries that we've imposed, that we've
right.
set, the well, this
boundary.
Is the invisible boundary. This is the park. This is mm-hmm. wilderness. Just across the boundary, there can be hunting and there can be trapping.
And there is, yeah.
And I've got nothing against hunting and trapping. My wife is Alaska native. All my brother-in-laws, they live by hunting and fishing and trapping. But the thing is, creatures like the wolves, they don't understand, they don't respect, they don't see those park boundaries.
Yeah.
They roam and they hunt outside the park boundaries, and then they're trapped, they're shot. And when there was protection outside the park boundaries for some years, and in a certain area where there were a lot of wolves. And during that period of protection, something like 40-45% of the visitors to the park saw wolves, because the packs would go out at certain times of year out beyond the boundaries, but they weren't shot and trapped. They mm-hmm. came back in, they had their pups, and people could come from all over the country, all over the world, really. And they were thrilled. They might hear them howling. They might see them on the hillside, maybe hunting, maybe chasing an animal. They could see the wolves, this primal great creature that just sends thrills and chills up mm-hmm. our back. But when that protection outside the park boundary was removed, within 4 years, only 4% of the visitors were seeing wolves.
Right.
So, you know,
of those hundreds of thousands of visitors, all of
yeah,
them are coming
yeah,
to Alaska,
yeah.
paying all the money to
yeah,
do it, right?
and you know, and so I think it causes us, should cause us all to pause and say, mm-hmm. look, we've had something extraordinary here.
Right.
You know, we don't have to be against hunting or against trapping to say, wait a second, here is an area. Let's protect those wild creatures. And because this is a magnet for people all over the world. I mean, you can think of this in many ways, just your love of wild animals, your love of Alaska, preserving what you love about it. You can think about it in economic terms. Alaska's going through a time when mm-hmm. oil prices are low. We're having trouble with our state budget. It's really tough on a lot of people. And tourism, inviting people to come here and share what we love about our state is a terrific source of revenue for the state, and it helps many families.
And hopefully this book is going to sort of spread that word and also that
conservation. Well, let's hope so. Yeah, let's hope so.
Thanks so much for being with me today.
Charles,
it's been a delight. Art Davidson wrote the foreword to Carl Batchrell's new book on the Alaska Range, and highly recommended. And Carl was with us in the first half of the show and really enjoyed our conversation. Our producer is Eric Bork. Hannah Doro is our assistant producer who helps line up our guests. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with me on Outdoor Explorer. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.